Prepared for, yeah.
The WEFT Music Archives are back. You can listen on demand thanks to our partners at Spinatron. Many of our music shows are once again available archived on our website. Go to our Spinatron calendar page at weft.org. and click on any of the green colored shows. You'll be able to start an in-browser player and listen to that show whenever you want. Look for the in-browser player, click on the little triangle to start playback. Now, because of copyright restrictions, the music shows can only remain online for 2 weeks. So if you caught part of a show and you want to hear it all, get back to WEFT within 2 weeks after the show first aired, and you can check out our amazing locally produced, homegrown grassroots music on your schedule, conveniently whenever you need to. WEFT.org, just click on the Spinatron calendar page. I think that is labeled recent spins on the WEFT homepage.
Elliott Counseling Group has been providing compassionate mental health care to the community for nearly 20 years. Elliott Counseling Group offers counseling and behavioral health medication support and management to children, adolescents, and adults of all ages. Elliott Counseling Group serves Champaign, Urbana, Tuscola, Tarleton, Mattoon, and surrounding communities, with visits currently held both in person and via online telehealth appointments. More information is available at ElliottCounselingGroup.com or by phone at 217-398-9066.
This is Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk, WEFT Champaign 90.1 on your FM dial. And we're broadcasting on the 10th of January, 2022. And I'm going to do some reminiscing. We have been trying to give you an idea of what we try to do as not-for-profit agencies. And that has included some repetition, but a lot of getting this sort of thing into action involves knowing each other and being able to bounce off each other's strengths and create a future. We've had a jolt lately. We have lost a fond warehouse and workshop and place where we could meet and work and process seeds and store materials, and we've lost it. It's a big complex with several different agencies in it, and we were renting by month and had a month to get out. We had a little bit more than that, but it was a trauma, and we had a lot of help from a lot of different people. Kind of amazing. So this warehouse was probably about 10,000 square feet, quite a lot of space, with an apartment in the end that allowed us to archive photographs in a rather controlled situation. It allowed us to do silkscreen prints and prepare them, and we had the warehouse is on a large lawn. It's just past Bonneville, and there was room for doing outside art, like working with puppets or working with structures like a tree built with little blue stem that would have a row of little blue stem out to a light, and you could light the tree. Unfortunately, it rained and it didn't happen, but it's the sort of thing that was very positive. We had a person, Chris Carl, and working with the planning department to get a master's degree, and he used this as a base. He would take a crane that we had and that was designed for working with railroad beds, and converted it to a road running crane and created a sculpted piece that was part of his master's thesis. Other people were happy to store wood that we took from an elevator that was coming down, and we could reuse it in different ways. We even had some small beams. Lots of demonstration things would let people know about their heritage. A barn, a piece of barn wood with a wooden plug, because the barns were erected without any nails. Early nails or wooden elevators, buckets that came up with grain from an area where the horse and cart could drop the grain, and it would be lifted up into a gearhead and put into various compartments. And so there was a small elevator and that people could go up in as an individual. And so some of those artifacts were there. There were also tools. If you have 50 people coming to volunteer, then you need tools that might be shovels in some cases, or seed collecting, or fire prevention. We don't prevent fires, we light fires, but you have to have a control burn. You need to have equipment to go with it, flappers, rakes. Often you can create the fire by just dragging it with a rake. You could grab hold of a bunch of material and let it give you a light, and then walk with it. So you don't have to have elaborate equipment, but you have to have equipment and character. We even whitewashed one wall with the thought of having ballroom dancers there. Didn't happen, but it's been rather wonderful. And now we've had to get out of there. And this is not a demolition situation. This is where we hope to find another warehouse, perhaps not as large, but one that's functional for the work we do. Then you have to figure out how to preserve. This is not like walking into a demolition where you know the building is going to be demolished afterwards. This is where Amazon is wanting a distribution area. So several agencies in that complex are going to have to remove in order to create a distribution center. But then we're not demolishing, we're moving concepts to other places. And then you have to know that not everyone will want to have a warehouse or a workshop. There are different ways of conserving places. You might want to put a cave out up on a prairie, but unfortunately that is almost an attractive nuisance for vandals and doesn't work. So you really have to have a base where you can drive a truck or a vehicle in and unload it, or store seed, or do carpentry work to create signs. And so part of this evacuation was to preserve useful equipment for a continuing Heartland Pathways. That means that you have to know exactly what you have to do, and you have to make that decision in a matter of a month, or it almost takes a week for you to get it into your noggin that this is you're going to have to remove from this building, and you've been there for many years and accumulated all sorts of things, including vehicles to go in parades and working tools. So what I'd like to do is to tell you how it is a challenge to tell people where you're walking. We have 33 mile of railroad bed in the Monticello area, and to actually define an area is at two levels. It can be for someone who is new, it can be this 200 yards with certain species. But in technicality, this comes with a survey with township and range, and you have to know whether this is in the north half section of an area that's well defined, and it's meets and bounds, and it's rather a challenge to read this quickly, especially if you haven't done it before. And then there are always some arguments about whose survey it is and where the monuments were, and that. So you're trying to look at your mission. Well, the mission of Heartland Pathways has been to activate and stimulate some ideas. We ran a early prairie conference at Mahomet and associated that with railbed prairies and reconstruction prairies. And from that, we were for years had worked to create an agency that would be an advocacy for prairie. And it happened. It got to be the Grand Prairie Friends. We did not personally, it is totally an organization that has run by itself without our supervising in any way, except we might I had a comment here and there. So that sort of situation has taken off and done very well. So the Grand Prairie Friends has done advocacy work. They've taken over prairies at Loda and Prospect, and these are remnant prairies that have been evolving for 10,000 years since glaciation moved away. But along the way, Grand Prairie Friends was in the right place at the right time and was given or got grants to take on forest preservation, which is much easier to do than to work with remnant prairies, which are down to 0.01% of what was prairie in Illinois. Champaign County was 94% prairie. So, but it's much easier to work with forest situations. There, you can hug a tree, you can get lumber from a tree, it has a certain ecosystem that is, the trees are related to each other. It's a fun place to be in a big grove, which was sort of where the trees were. And that has been a forte of the Grand Prairie Friends at the present time. They're also recreating prairie, which is helpful, but it can't recreate 10,000 years of humus development on glacial till to create a soil that has mostly been taken over for agriculture and has lost its character to the point where you have to apply fertilizer and use it as a medium for growing crops. The few areas we have are in cemeteries that have been not always been kept, which has allowed the native species to grow, or along railroad lines where there was a by happenstance regulation that you could not invade the right of way. Some people do, but it still keeps the right of way for the railroad. Those places generate some of our original prairie. So what do we do? How do we talk to you and others and say what we're doing? Well, one of the first innovative things we did was to buy 33 miles of railroad bed. We were doing it, others were doing it, especially in the East. And that was observed by the Congress, who was a little bit worried about taking out too many railroads. The railroads allowed access, but then came roads, and the roads often paralleled the railroad lines. And there were little wooden elevators here and there, about 5 miles apart, and they were obsolete, and they didn't provide a train load of cars that could be moved across the country. So the Steiger's Act allowed those short lines to be abandoned, and they would have various titles. Some would be owned by the railroad, some would be easements that were rented by the railroad line, and some were adverse possessions that had just taken over, and nobody knew who was going through 15 feet on the corner of a field. So you have an innovative railroad bed with three truss bridges and an opportunity for re-railing, if possible, if it was considered astute to create mainly the grain lines were not so connecting. So if you did have a connectivity, then that was helpful. The Rail Banking Act created a situation where the railroads realized that people were buying rail beds for re-rail, for trail, and for biological preservation. And that happened, and it was figured it was cheaper to pay for the development of those rail beds as trails in the existing situation, rather than going back in 50 years' time and trying to recreate a railroad bed. Typical was a rail bed between a Banner and Danville, which could in fact be used for industry or what have you at another time. Growing around this was a rail-to-trail conservancy, which realized that this was an ideal situation for mostly recreation. It's axiomatic that so Heartland Pathways buying a railroad bed was an innovation that was encouraging people to think this way. We weren't the only ones by any means, but it helped. The next step is that the rail trail movement people got funding to do this. We were before there was any funding, and it may be that we get funding in the future, but we're in three different segments around a railroad museum, which means we have to talk about the area. And that's where we come into discussion between grain lines and historic trains and natural areas on either side and moraines that give us some terrain to think about and some ecological niches, a Sangamon River, an Allenton Park. And so we look especially between Danville and Champaign-Urbana and Decatur, but we have also been down in the Arcola area where we encourage the preservation of 30 odd miles of rail bed, which unfortunately has been returned to farmers. Some farmers know the value of the ecology, the genetics that's there, and they've kept the genetics. But basically, it was purchased with a view of having a rail trail, and it was felt locally that that rail trail was not contiguous because 11 sites had already been sold to farmers. But okay, so now we have Heartland Pathways fitting into a complex where we have some spin-offs. The Kickapoo Trail is in the hands of an established forest preserve and a preservation or conservation district. And those two are a little different. When George Fell was working with early ecologists, Vestfall and Shelford. He and Barbara, his wife, went off to New York or Washington, bought a house, and Offset Press and created the Nature Conservancy, which is now worldwide. George had a conflict between his board, which really wanted to concentrate on some special areas, and George wanted to have TNC and Nature Conservancies chapters throughout the country. He returned to Illinois. He'd grown up in Rockford, along with his wife, and stood on an airport to preserve the demolition of a rather special ecology that was going to be a runway. He returned to Rockford and had a lot to do with creating a forest preserve, which actually got expanded into recreation, because recreation dominates preservation. You have people coming in, have people who can buy land from the government, from a Louisiana purchase for 7 cents an acre. And those people need to have houses. They need the railroads, but then they have the roads. They channelize the rivers so that they don't have huge meanders. The water can get off quickly. Champaign County, for instance, was very wet. And one of the things that small communities like to do is they like to recreate. They have to create their own recreation, their own theaters, or their own interaction. And so recreation somewhat dominates in the forest preserve system. The forest reserve system can choose to do a preservation system, but the conservation district, which George Fell also had his fingers in, is more oriented. Agencies have more permission to be involved in preservation. George Fell also went back to his territory in Rockford and created a research organization, which became a powerhouse in preservation in Illinois. I want to comment on something else at this time. Early 1800s, you got settlement and a sort of a colonialism. You had a people who had come through from early Stone Age man was out writing, was out shipping, gradually occupying various countries, warring with each other, developing writing, having the ability to bring people together, and gradually you infuse religions and set up rules of the game, which were very strongly oriented to males and white males. You had early England with Celtics on one side and Vikings and Saxons on another. Move through this era when the U.S. was being colonialized, was arguing about taxation from the central core of our royalties. And you had a conflict between the two. So you have to believe that the small group of royalty, the kings and queens and dukes and earls, and had to be bold enough to become prime ministers or governments that ruled a British Empire that where the sun never set. You still had Queen Victoria, you had Queen Elizabeth before that, you had a royalty that had a responsibility here, and the lesser beings were respectful of the royalty. Unfortunately, they were often pushed off their small plots of land by royalty that really needed to have landscaped areas and castles and development. But come to the post 60s era, and America was developing quickly on its own, and the men and women had a degree of freedom that didn't exist in Europe. The average woman who belonged to a royalty clan was controlled, and there were rules of the game that were very strict. So there was a movement where American leaders, people who made money and entrepreneurs, would roam into England and Europe. And one of those people was a family named Jerome. And that gentleman had four children, four daughters. One of them passed, but the three daughters found their way to Paris and to other places in Europe and became very independent people. And often it was not unusual for a royalty from Europe to go to America and actually find that the women there were free to do things that women in royalty couldn't do, and they matched and married. And so I'm reading a book about Jenny Churchill. She happened to be in Paris, a very strong-willed, very intelligent person at the age of 20. Lord Randolph Churchill decided that she would be an ideal bride, and he took her on, and she became his loyal associate and often a leader in her own right. The gentleman had had some career that led to syphilis, so he wasn't totally on top of things, but he was astute enough to be very close to being Prime Minister of England. It's interesting to me that I grew up in a very small community in Australia, and there we were near to a family named Fruin. And one of the three daughters, the American daughters that grew up in New York and went to, across the sea and became musicians and language people and people who could handle a discussion that was political, which was not what the average European woman were doing. So Frauen was a relationship to the royalty in England, and he married one of the three sisters. So there's Randolph and Churchill and the Frauen family. And my parents got involved in a different way. So this is one of those stories that is unusual, but it makes you think. So there we are with a house, a school teacher's house. My father was one teacher, school teacher, and the school teachers had a house, and the school was across the road. And this, I could remember Captain Hugh Frauen sitting on the stairwell that meant that the house at the rear was at level with the land, and house at the front was perhaps 6 feet off the ground. My father had it as a carpentry shop. And so Hugh Frauen and his wife had children named Viking and Saxon and Jenny. And Viking had a bone problem, and for some reason Captain Hugh Frauen had got to talk to my people, and my mother, who was Cockney from London, and that probably added to Hugh Frauen had space in Dorrigo, which was 2,000 feet higher up on the hill, where there was a continental divide that where one plate is moving over another plate, one continental plate, and there's volcanic soils, and it's a little richer than at Thora, where we were. But eventually a Viking came to live with us and go to school with us, and eventually married into the community at Thora. You have to know that this is a family, the Frauen family was in Africa, they were in Canada, they were also in Australia. And so the bounces of the royalty and the rest of the population were still there in other countries that were administered by England and Belgium and Holland and Spain and Portugal, and like Brazil is Portuguese. And so you think about this, and we knew that Captain Frauen was related to Churchill. Well, the relationship was that Randolph Churchill had a son, two sons, and the one son that made it to political clout was Winston Churchill. So there was a tickle of relationship to old England that I'm sure my mother appreciated. My father was much more practical. Part of his family came to Utah and became Mormons, and part of them went to Australia. So I don't know so much about my father's background. But then you infuse a woman's role and preservation's role. Do you become a a Taft or people who go out and save conservation areas in the U.S.? Do you save similar areas in the oceans or in other countries? So getting back to Heartland Pathways, we working with diffuse relationships. You need to know some of the history. You need to know that people could buy land for 7 cents an acre. You needed to know that Chicago was going to develop as a major city, but yet there was downstate areas that could be governmental bodies. You had to have Lewis and Clark that explored the Missouri all the way out to the mountains to the west, and then eventually cross into the rivers that ran west into the Pacific. So this is only in the 1860s and 70s, and it was sometimes for a very short time. Randolph Churchill was a nabob in Parliament and for just 6 years, and then retired from it. Not an easy task, not an easy job, not an easy background with a disease that was little known, and was a wife that was very dramatic. He was very dependent on her, and to think of it, if he had become Prime Minister of England, she would have had some control of the world as far as development was concerned. The colonial people have had to back off gradually, but you have to imagine that you too could look at your ecology and think about what you might do. So we have stories in Heartland Pathways. We would like to have a rail trail that from Rantoul to Paxton, which would also connect with a rail trail east-west through Rantoul to where the Grand Prairie Friends has a short line. We still have areas in the Arcola area where the Amish are, and where we've had years of meetings to try and figure out how we could conserve the railroad bed. We have to talk about railroad beds. Some people think that our objective is to buy railroad beds and to play trains with railroad beds, but that's where the remnant prairie is. That's where we have to be astute enough to buy when the railroad is being taken out. And then you have to think about re-rail. Between Whiteheath and Seymour, we're re-railing in order to allow historic trains to come into Champaign. A whole nother sequence, but every time you save a railroad bed, you're saving this prairie soil on either side, and hopefully some prairie plants and remnants. We are very pleased with the Kickapoo Trail, but it wouldn't be there if we didn't make the initial moves to preserve the dignity of that line as a recreational line. Recreation dominates, so we have to be very careful. At the moment, one of Heartland Pathways' responsibilities is to look at 10 miles between Ogden and Oakwood, because we don't want it so wide that you destroy the remnant prairie on either side and the remnant soils. So I've been working with people who have me to They're in their car and they're driving to Fithian, and I can tell them what to look for in this conservation area. Does it look like prairie? No, it's a poor facsimile of what we have had in the past. And so is it a edge timber? Is it are there trees? Yes, there's trees, because when railroads go through wetland, they're going to make sure that they have drains to take away the water, because you don't want a sloppy railroad bed, and so you need to build a railroad bed that becomes a trail. But it doesn't have to be so wide that you interaction with the neighbor vegetation is corn and soybeans. You need to have a little bit of prairie there that reminds people that this really was a rich prairie ecosystem, and that we have a responsibility to preserve all the dignity of the biochemicals and plants that may become active plants in the future. If we expect to go to other countries to get soybeans or what have you, then we have to expect that other countries may want to find a biochemical in our ecosystem that they can use and simulate. So this runs back to medicine and science and a thought process. So the whole concept is diffuse. You look for a high school that is on Route 45 that could become a visitor center for ecotourism. We lost that. It was Arroyo High School, very much revered by a lot of Paxton people, but it was determined that it should be coming down. So it came down, but there's another high school that might be be used as a visitor center along with other things. So you have a story about a high school, a story about Prospect Cemetery, which is a native cemetery. You have a story about the railroad bed and remnant prairie at the north end especially. You have a moraine, a Bloomington moraine that has a front area where water ran off from melting ice, and a back area that was more gentle to Ludlow. So there's niches for plants. You have a drying period when the glaciers dried up. The meltways would blow sand dune material across the country. So you have lus. And if you are in a wet situation, the lus is very sloppy. But if you're in a dry situation, it's very hard. And the plant that grows on the lus, the liatris that might be 4 foot high in a rich Dummer and a Flanagan soil on the advanced edge of a moraine, that might be a mere 10 inches high. There's a road, an old 45 that parallels the new 45. There's an interurban, so we have to think about what we do with that. And so there's a story, and how do you connect the pieces? How do you work with the Dewey Fisher Grain Company, which has a 8 mile short line that brings grain into Rantoul and joins it up with other trains that you eventually have a 125 car train. That's acceptable to Canadian National or whoever is running the railroad line. And it's a main line, and the main lines are doing well. They transport material at a far cheaper base than with semi-trailers. It's not quite so convenient, but our own solo cup area, four railroad cars would be have to be replaced, but 13 semi-trailers with an accident rate that is very different, and with a cost to the road repair that is often not included in road transport. The convenience is there, but not always the finance to repair the road. So you have a transportation system that went in the 50s and 60s and is now beginning to decay. So you have bridges that need to be replaced at a tremendous cost, which isn't always equal to that of what the railroads have done in a parallel manner with not quite so recent development. You see right now that during the holidays, the shipping containers coming across the oceans, huge containers that are in harbor and can't get unloaded. And so they go onto rails and roads and create a network that is so dominant and so intricate that if you mess with one factor of it, then you can mess up a whole nation in terms of the network that is involved. We have to get together and talk to each other, and the board for Heartland Pathways has to decide, now that they've lost a warehouse, what they want to do, and that will be quite a challenge. And it may go in a different direction than you expect. It may be a new demand put upon the system. I talked to people about the railroads going across the northwest corner of the Champaign County near Foosland. Wonderful prairie there. And does it get saved or does it get challenged? I just have right in front of me a message from Ameren that it wants to work with an easement that they have on our prairie. We bought a prairie between Seymour and White Heath, and it was very good at the time because in the herbicides hadn't been used as a control mechanism at that time. Now the herbicides have come, and blanket herbiciding can do wonders for your prairie. And so we have to work with Ameren and beg them not to use herbicides, if necessary to spot herbicide. But we ourselves have to control the trees that are there. We would prefer to spot herbicide a tree rather than to have an herbicide cocktail that is going to keep trees out for 3 years. If they're going to plant replacement prairie or replacement, we don't want a whole bunch of brome grass and non-native plants. So how do we work with Ameren to do that, and how do we get funding to do that? So we have a GoFundMe, and we hope that will help us to stress different principles that we have in our mission. There's a railroad coming in from a rail trail potential coming in from Bloomington. How do we connect that up with our regional planning? Regional planning is not easy to do. People don't like to be told what to do, but we need to be able to talk to each other so that sometimes the person who is opposed to what you're doing because they don't exactly know what you're doing becomes a staunch supporter because they understand. That means we need media people and we need people who could do accounting and office work as well as work in the field. And in some cases, we do have to have mowers to make a statement with our mowing. So you mow a little bit, and that's a statement. You don't need to have a 15-foot bush hog come in and destroy the roadside management. So you have to work with the Department of Transportation and the Department of Natural Resources and with the Prairie State Conservation Coalition and other bodies that have been formed to do stewardship. And so I want you to think about this, to do a little windshield drive of the Kickapoo Trail, for instance, of the Highland Pathways area, to look at the Railroad Museum, to think about how it could come into town. How does that relate to development of downtown Champaign? The concept of a $250 million development in downtown Champaign. So what do you have as alternatives for the population of people who enjoy bars and meeting with each other and talking to each other and doing wonderful things? Please think beautiful thoughts, and I think we are getting time for WEFT to input and for Banner Public Television to input also. And we revere those agencies that have let us poke our nose into conservation in small places. Right now I'm thinking of a Barnhart Prairie, which took plants from 45 when it was enlarged. And now it has, the family has a 100 acres of prairie. And so you can do things. You don't have to be a genius or let other people do it. Think about belonging to the Audubon Society or the Sierra Club or local forest preserves or conservation districts. And stirring your oar in the water and seeing that the water remains clear and not leached into by coal leftovers. And so there's room for you out there. Please be involved. This is Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk, WEFT Champaign 90.1 on your FM dial.
Daily Bread Soup Kitchen, an all-volunteer operation, is located at 116 North 1st Street in Champaign. Their mission is to feed the hungry of Champaign County 7 days a week from 11 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. Because 1 in 7 adults and 1 in 5 children in our county are food insecure, and because so many have lost their jobs or are experiencing a lack of resources during the coronavirus crisis, the need is right there. While the dining room is closed during this time, good nutritious meals and sack lunches are available but for pickup at the front door daily. For more information, visit dailybreadsoupkitchen.com. Guests will get good meals and a little certainty in these uncertain times.
You are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, streaming live at weft.org.
It's WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM.